Podcast. My name is Patrick Barbieri, Executive Director of Lab Collaborative. Happy New Year, everybody. This is the first podcast of the new year, and it was a great one. But I'll talk about that in a second. First, a few updates on some events. The Lab Transition Fair will be on Thursday, April 16th at 6:30. It will be held again at the Scottish Rite Museum in Lexington. Some people call it the American Heritage Museum. It's the same place where we do our graduation. So look forward to seeing you all there. Again, such an important event for parents, if they have children in preschool through high school. It really doesn't matter. This is an opportunity where we bring you the best possible workshops that we can that's going to help you prepare for the future. Okay, Lab Prom. Really looking forward to this one. The last one we had was just awesome. We're doing the same theme this year. Jeannie Bono is the coordinator of this, and she just does a tremendous job. So we're going to be doing the whole red carpet thing. It'll be at the Burlington Marriott. And again, just such a wonderful event. So really looking forward to that. And Lab Special Olympics. It's going to be a little bit later this year. It'll be on Friday, May 22nd. So just put that in your calendars. There'll be more information coming out about that. But we had to schedule it a little bit later in the year this year. So, all right. So let me get to this podcast. This is a special one. And sometimes podcasts come up because I just happen to meet with somebody, and on the spot, you know, I think, oh, this would be a great podcast to do and share with everybody. So about, I don't know, maybe 8 to 10 years ago, I got together with Emily Rubin. And let me first tell you who Emily is. Emily is the assistant professor of psychiatry at UMass Medical School, and she is also the director of the sibling support at Eunice Kennedy Shriver Center. And she is the co-founder and executive director of the Massachusetts Sibling Support Network. And Emily is a licensed social worker. So we had got together and we talked about the sibling groups. Again, like I said, this is about 8 to 10 years ago. And out of that meeting, I explained to her that I had gone to a sibling group back in the maybe 1977, 78, right in the place that we were meeting at the Shriver Center in Waltham. We just sparked this whole conversation, and she ended up doing a wonderful article with me in their Spotlight magazine. And then for many years, we lost touch, and Emily and I got in touch just maybe a few weeks back. She came over and we met in my office, and that's when the idea to do this podcast came up. And I just got to say that, you know, this for me, I have to say, as we were talking, it was so reflective, because Emily just has a nice way of talking about the research behind sibling support. And I learned a lot, you know, the differences of sibling support with families who have mental health and trauma compared to maybe the sibling group that I went to with my sister who has Down syndrome. So Emily is just a wealth of knowledge, and as she's talking and just stating some of the research that she has done, it just made a whole lot of sense. So again, for me, as she was talking, I would just kind of drift off a little bit reflecting about what I was going through, and then I would ask her a question about it or shared it during the podcast. So this was a great one. I had a great time. We could have spoke, you know, for long, you know, many more hours just about, you know, kind of how we, you know, want to get the word out to people and just share, you know, how important this experience can be for siblings. So I hope you enjoy this one. I think you will. You'll hear more from Emily because we are going to have her come and speak to one of our parent groups. Because again, I think I want to try to get this information out to everybody in the special ed community. But I know, you know, we have over 300 students on lab. So there's many siblings out there that I'm sure could really benefit from listening to this podcast and also going to a talk with Emily. Okay, hope you enjoy it. Thank you. Emily, welcome to our podcast. Good to see you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year. It's really nice to be here.
Was it a good New Year for you? Was it busy around the New Year? So was it for our family? It was first time was actually relaxed, and I don't know why. I mean, I think for the schools we had a an extra long break. It was one of those things where it just fell, you know, on those days, so it was a little extra long, you know. So it takes you, what, 3 days just to get into vacation?
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I took those first 3 days and just thought of it that way, and that was nice. So yeah, so Happy New Year.
Thanks. We had a really great New Year. We went to Los Angeles just for a few days to celebrate my mother-in-law's 80th birthday.
Wow,
so
congratulations.
That was really nice.
That's awesome. Yeah, we this is the first New Year's too. My wife and I went out, so we talked. We met a couple of weeks ago, and I play in a band. So our band had a gig on New Year's Eve at Waxies in Lexington, and you know, I said to my wife, I said, "Should we do this?" And she was like, "Yeah." It was the first time that we said that we had actually gone out to do something together on New Year's Eve. Even though I was playing, but we had a blast. So it was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. Anyway.
All right, so let's talk about siblings. I think, you know, so just to start, I think we met 5, 6, 7 years ago when we did the Spotlight night,
right?
So when I was in your office, it was at Triver at that time in Waltham. Mm-hmm. So I remember our conversation, and we started talking, and I said to you that in 1978, might have been 77, 78, I actually went to a sibling group at Triver when I was 13, 14 years old. And that was our first conversation started into it. And I think you didn't believe me that I actually went because it was so like, it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
But for me, I've seen the stuff that you put out, which we'll talk about during the podcast. So I experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think I took away from that, well, you know, at age 13 and 14, you don't want to go. My mom said, "I think this would be good for you. I'd like you to try it." All my brothers and sisters went. But we were all different, part of different groups. They set them up by age. But I remember I didn't want to go. It was like on a Sunday night. And I was like, "Oh, who am I going to talk to? And why do I need to do this? There's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with, you know, my sister, anybody in our family." It was just one of those things where, you know, I didn't want to go to it as a teenager. But the experience was great. It wasn't anything remarkable at that time in my life, but I tell you, the biggest part of that is what I'm doing now as I became an adult and remembering what we did during that time. So I think for some people in the moment, it might be good. For others, who knows? I mean, I just think that was, for me, I remember it fondly because later in my life and thinking about my experiences with my sister, who had Down syndrome, it was definitely something I recommend to people. So let me just shut this off over here. I have my Slack on, which is giving me notifications. So anyway, so that was my first experience, and then we ended up doing the article, which I really appreciate you doing, because was I shared with our parents and to say, you know, even though I'm executive director, you know, I went through all this stuff mm-hmm. that maybe, you know, your son or daughters might do, so.
And I imagine that was very meaningful for the families here to know that you get it as a sibling.
And I think what you can talk about from a personal standpoint, and I think that has a lot more impact than me just saying, here's some research and here's some data that I think you mm-hmm. should, you know, why was it important and things like that. So, again, I wanted to share that to start off the podcast, because this isn't the first time we're meeting. We've actually had some long discussions over the years. So, but let's talk a little bit about your work and what you are doing, because I gotta say that I get your emails and I've seen stuff and I think that it's such important work, and I'm glad we're talking here, because I think to share this to not just the lab folks, I mean anybody who's listening to this podcast, I think this is so important. So. Then I want to talk a little bit about how we get that information out there, because I think not enough people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really another purpose of this podcast. So, it'd be great if you can just start off, talk a little bit about the work that you, maybe how you started it and how you kind of got,
sure.
you know, got it going. That would be great.
Sure. So, like you, I'm an adult sibling, although my sister has special healthcare needs. She's doing really well. She was born with a congenital heart problem. She was diagnosed with tetralogy of Fallot, mm-hmm. which now is treated much more, I don't want to say easily, but there is a protocol of heart surgery that mm-hmm. usually happens during infancy. But when my sister was growing up, there was no such treatment. So she was mm-hmm. one of the early cases of experimental open heart surgery among children. She was treated at Children's Hospital, mm-hmm. and I think it was Children's actually, but at any rate, when she was about 11, she had experimental open heart surgery at the same time that a family friend had the same condition, the same surgery, and that child did not survive. Mm-hmm. So it was a very intense time in our family growing up with a sister who really, yeah. I mean, we grew up with a life or death crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you, I grew up just thinking, like, this is normal,
right.
whatever.
Right.
So I have a sister that really can't, you know, participate in activities and mm-hmm. can't even go to school. And but she did incredibly well after her surgery, and she's thriving and just a wonderful person.
That's great.
But that experience really shaped me, mm-hmm. just as your experience shaped you.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined the Eunice Kennedy Shriver Center at UMass Medical School in 2010, and I started to conduct research on siblings. Because it was, like as you said, it's a topic that's near and dear to
mm-hmm.
the heart of a adult sibling. And so the research that I conduct at the Eunice Kennedy Shriver Center is different from the nonprofit that I run, the Massachusetts mm-hmm. Sibling Support Network. So mm-hmm. I can talk a little bit about both,
absolutely.
If that would be helpful.
Yes,
that would
be great.
So the research at UMass Medical School is looking at the impact of mental illness on typically developing siblings.
Mm-hmm.
So I have, I'm overseeing a research study. We've had over 2,000 participants,
wow.
Which is really exciting. When I first started, I thought maybe if I'm lucky, I'll get 50 participants. But this research study is now, it's underway at Cambridge Health Alliance on the inpatient psych unit for children and adolescents. It's also been implemented as a quality improvement initiative at different inpatient and outpatient centers across mm-hmm. the state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's underway at Worcester Recovery Center and at the CANDU Clinic. Are you
mm-hmm.
familiar with CANDU?
Nah. Yeah.
So that's the Center for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders. I think I covered the acronym. That's actually a program of UMass Medical School.
Okay.
So the research I do is about building resiliency and decreasing trauma mm-hmm. among siblings of kids who are admitted for psychiatric hospitalization. Also empowering parents, because
mm-hmm.
by the time a child needs to get inpatient treatment. The parents are usually feeling pretty overwhelmed, sometimes feeling very negative and critical and bad about themselves. So one of the parts of my research is to really build the competency and confidence of parents and equip them with tools to support the siblings. And then the third part of that the research study is to train clinicians to practice family-centered mental health care. So at Cambridge Hospital alone, we've had 39 trainees, mostly psychiatry residents, who rotate through the program that I started called, the program is called Sibling Support Program, a family-centered mental health initiative. So they rotate through that program and they fulfill their requirements for group work. And they also get hands-on experience working with typically developing siblings. So in the this research that I'm doing is really looking at a very narrow band of siblings and the sibling experience. And what we found is that siblings of kids with mental health issues are at higher risk of developing anxiety and depression, are at greater risk of developing maladaptive behaviors themselves. And it kind of, it makes sense if you just think about it, you know, growing up with a brother or sister who is struggling with psychiatric issues and is often lashing out either verbally or physically at the sibling. So of course the siblings are not going to escape unscathed. But the exciting part about that research is that we're really getting a lot of good feedback from siblings about what their experience is like. We're getting good feedback from parents about what we can do to help support the every member of the family, not just the sibling. And it's also wonderful to see these clinicians that are really embracing the idea of family, of working with siblings, because family-centered mental health care has been around for quite a while, but for most people what that means is supporting parents. So the fact that these clinicians are actively engaging with the siblings, we actually just published a paper about the impact of participating in this sibling support program on clinicians. So we surveyed a number of clinicians across disciplines at Cambridge Health Alliance and found out, and the findings were that the clinicians that participated in this program were more likely to practice family-centered mental health care, were more likely to inquire about the well-being of siblings, and felt better equipped to support siblings.
So, so with the siblings that, that you're doing the research with, if they had higher rates of anxiety and depression, when you interviewed them or whoever interviewed them, were they able to put that connection together with having a sibling that was having an issue? Or was that something that, you know, they were having issues with, but they just never connected that?
Well, that's a great question. So the siblings we work with are at very different stages developmentally. They, we work with siblings starting at age 5 to 18. So there's a different level of understanding and a different way of perceiving what their situation is. So, for example, a 5-year-old sibling might think, oh, my brother is just mean. I have a mean brother. Whereas an older sibling would have, you know, a more nuanced understanding, but also would look at kind of parental involvement and might say, my brother gets away with everything. He never gets punished. He has really bad behavior. So one of the goals of the sibling group is for those siblings to have a safe place to share their story and to learn that they're not alone. And that caring adults are available for them. Many of the siblings end up keeping, especially as they get older, they end up keeping a lot of personal worries to themselves, and they're very acutely aware of how burdened their parents are, and they don't want to add to that burden. And another theme that has emerged among the siblings is a strong sense of guilt. So many siblings. I actually was working with a 10-year-old boy who felt responsible for his sister's suicide attempt. And fortunately, she survived. Mm. But he said to me, I was at the kitchen table doing my homework, and I should have known that she was upstairs taking pills. And that is quite a burden for a 10-year-old.
Absolutely.
So the sibling experience when you're dealing with mental health issues and mental illness is very different from the sibling experience when you're dealing with brothers and sisters that have Down syndrome,
right,
for example.
Right. Absolutely. Because as you're telling me that, I'm thinking of my own experience, and that never came into play.
Right.
I think it was more, again, of my parents just thinking, we have to spend more time with our younger sister because she has these needs, and we want to make sure that we're still paying attention to you. So I think that there was that kind of just being mindful of that, but certainly not the guilt or that burden was not there. Okay? Mm-hmm. I'm just speaking from my experience.
But right.
To hear you talk about this, that's intense.
Yeah. Well, there's research that's been done on, I haven't done research on adult siblings, but the research that has been done tells us that adult siblings of people with all kinds of disabilities tend to be like you. They enter the helping profession.
Mm-hmm.
They're very
yeah.
loyal mm-hmm. and generous and very mm-hmm. kind. I'd like to also talk about the Massachusetts Sibling Support Network.
Yeah,
and
sure.
that... So I'm an executive director of that organization that serves individual siblings of people with all kinds of disabilities across mm-hmm. the sibling lifespan. Mm-hmm. And our board of directors is made up of adult siblings. And mm-hmm. so we have this kind of this inside joke where everyone is so accommodating mm-hmm. and so helpful and will say things like, oh, you're such a sibling. So it's an unusual type of person that... That emerges from families where there are disabilities.
Right, right. And that's nice to hear those characteristics. I'm going to make sure my wife listens to this because that's what I want to know. But that it does, I can understand how that would make sense, though.
Well, the other thing that's, I mean, there are a couple of other trends that are interesting among adult siblings. And one is that oftentimes adult siblings will use their brother or sister's disability as a kind of litmus test for romantic relationships.
That's interesting, yeah.
So they might say, perhaps bring their brother or sister
right,
who's nonverbal and see how their spouse,
great point, yeah,
future
that,
spouse
that makes
acts.
Sense.
Yeah.
Again, I'm just going through all this stuff and how I grew up. Did I do that with my sister? Probably like not thinking about it, but probably you take that information in of how somebody would treat somebody that, you know,
right.
was a sibling with special needs. So, yeah, good point.
So there are a lot of, you know, unusual opportunities for growth, but there are also a lot of challenges depending on the type of family, the culture of the family you grew up in, and the type of disability that the brother or sister has.
Right.
One other point that... is of interest to me is that the sibling experience closely mirrors the parents' experience.
Mm-hmm.
So if parents are able to be very supportive and embracing and patient with the child with a disability, then it's more likely that the siblings will interact with that child in a similar mm-hmm. way.
Right. Yeah, good point. I will say something, again, as you're talking, this is, I'm reflecting a lot. With my parents and we, at the age that we were at, I think one thing that really helped, I played hockey. My brother played hockey and we were, you know, around people all the time. And my parents always made sure that my sister was at the games.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I didn't consciously think that they were doing this, but she came to every single game. So it just became a norm that she was there and that she was part of the hockey community, which was thriving at that time in Lexington and traveling and going places. So again, as a parent, not keeping my sister removed from that, she was very much a part of it. Even when I got to the high school, she would hang out with the cheerleaders and
aww.
Doing that. And they just kind of, so, that piece, again, now I'm thinking I give my parents so much credit mostly my mom was doing this, but that was a piece, had she not been part of that, that maybe I would have thought differently about her in some ways. But it just became, she was at the game, she was wandering around, people were talking to her, and they knew who she was. So again, thank you, because as you're talking through this, it definitely makes me think about the past and maybe the whys and the hows and, you know.
Well, I think your parents were very forward-thinking in terms of getting the siblings into sibling support groups, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. Of which there were very few at that time.
Yeah.
And also including her. I mean, that's what true inclusion is.
Absolutely.
So that's wonderful to hear.
But it's good for the siblings, because I think that they always thought the burden's going to be on the kids. They didn't want that at all. Mm-hmm. So certainly just making it a normal part of life and what we're doing. And so thank you for stirring up those things that make you think about those. So
mm-hmm. It's funny, too, that, you know, since we did grow up in the same town.
Yes, yeah.
You know, what, you know, our families were dealing with different types of disability issues and... you know, it's too bad we didn't know each other then.
I know. Probably crossed each other's paths many times, but if there was something in the schools, say. You know,
well, I think you're, I don't mean to be, you know, talk about age, but I think you're a few years older than I am.
Yes, I am. But my sister was 12 years younger than me, which was, that's quite an age span.
Yeah, you know, between that is age difference.
Yeah. She's the youngest, and... she graduated at 22 in 1998, so she was part of that whole, when they were first starting early intervention, and mm-hmm. so there were a lot of new things that were going on in just special education at that time.
So, wait, she was born in 98?
No, she was born in 76.
Okay, that's right.
She graduated.
That makes sense. Graduated in 98, okay.
But early intervention had first started, I can't remember what year, but I remember her just getting in early, and it was a good time to kind of be involved with those kind of things. So I mm-hmm. think when and how the sibling groups came about, I don't know how that was developed at Tribe or whose idea was, you know, but the people who were starting, I think it was the first sibling group that they had at Tribe at that mm-hmm. time, if I remember correctly. So there was some good stuff. So I want to hear more about the network, obviously, because I think that is wonderful, and I'll be able to meet the group soon. So
I'm looking forward to that. So the Massachusetts Sibling Support Network is a nonprofit that we got our nonprofit status in 2011. So we're a young nonprofit, and our mission is threefold. The first part is to, let's see if I can remember all of this. The first part is to create welcoming communities for siblings across the lifespan. Mm-hmm. And so we do a lot of different kind of social networking events for adult siblings. Younger siblings actually aren't that interested in meeting other young mm-hmm. siblings. And mm-hmm. it's really because they've got their whole life outside of the brother or sister with a disability. And so it doesn't make sense to them. Like,
I can see that.
Why would I get together with another 8-year-old? We have nothing in common.
Exactly. Yep.
But as siblings age, they find that there's more in common, especially mm-hmm. when they enter, if they transition into caregiving roles or advocacy roles, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden there's this whole new language to learn about government benefits and housing and medical mm-hmm. advocacy.
So much.
And that really brings adult siblings together.
I agree.
So that's the first part of our mission. The second part is to expand the range and availability of sibling services across the state, because mm-hmm. there are very few sibling supports mm-hmm. available still now. So we provide technical assistance to agencies that want to offer sibling support services but don't know how to. We also have on our website, we have a new fully accessible website,
thanks
to New England Index that developed it for us. On our website, we have a geographically organized resource list of, I think, all sibling services across the state.
Mm-hmm.
So providers go to that list, families go to that list. So that's a great resource. And then the third part of our mission is, I might have to...
While you're thinking about that, we'll put all these links on the, when I actually put out the podcast, because I know we throw a lot of sites out there. So I just want to make sure when parents are listening to this, and we have parents from 70 district students that mm-hmm. attend us, so I certainly, and many more people listening to this, but all those resources and all those links that Emily has shared with me, I want to, you know, you don't have to remember them, or if you're trying to write them down now, don't. They'll be there
right
on the website.
And so, that's actually, yeah. that made me remember the last part of our mission statement, which okay. is providing education on sibling-related issues. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the links, actually, is a handout on our educational presentations.
Okay.
And the presentations are for providers, for family members, for adult siblings, and they really talk about what it's like to grow up with a brother or sister mm-hmm. with disabilities, strategies to support siblings, resources for siblings, and how to help with future planning. Mm. That's a big concern.
Emphasize how important that is. Again, as I'm thinking, we should plan a night for you. I don't know if we talked about this last time, to come to our parent group.
I'd love to.
That would be awesome. And I talk about planning a lot. And what I've seen in the last couple of parent groups is that the parents are actually bringing a sibling.
Mm-hmm.
They're older. They may be early 20s or late teens. Because of the planning, I try to write about that just a lot. What to be aware of, not that you have to start doing it immediately, and it's really nice to see a parent come up and introduce them to me and say, this is, you know, a sibling of a student that attends our program, and I'm trying to get them ready mm-hmm. for the future. And I tell you, this is why we're doing it all. So I think as a extension of this, just to hone in on the siblings and talk about all the research you've done and how it impacts them. Let's do a parent night. We'll talk about that
sure,
later. But
that
I couldn't remember if I brought that up to you last time. But
I don't think so. But I do want to mention one thing about future planning, which is that personally, I believe that every sibling needs to make a choice on his or her own about the level of involvement that they want to have with the mm-hmm. individual with disabilities. Some siblings don't want to have anything to do with their brother or sister with disabilities, and I believe that that has to be okay.
Yeah.
So I also know that most siblings, because of this, most adult siblings, because of the profile that I already mentioned about being kind and mm-hmm. giving, and most siblings do want to take on those roles. But I never want families to think that that's something that has to happen. And of course, there are cultural variations as mm-hmm. well, because mm-hmm. in some families, it's not discussed. It's just expected that the yes. sibling will be the caretaker or the caregiver.
Yeah. That's a great point. That has come up. I guess I didn't think that way at the beginning because I was just had that assumption, you know. Mm-hmm. But by no means could that be the best decision for the family or the sibling to be able to do that. So I think my perceptions of that have that changed quite a bit.
And then there's also the feelings about the individual with the disability. Maybe that individual doesn't want the mm-hmm. sibling be in a caregiving role.
Yeah.
So, you know, and if we think about person-centered planning, we really mm-hmm. need to take all of this into account.
Yeah, it goes deeper than I had thought originally. And that was... I forget who the speaker was that I went to listen to. It'll come to me. And they started talking all about that. And I thought, what a great point, because some parents had ended up confiding in me, like, oh yeah, my older son will never become the caregiver because of these reasons. And it totally made sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other things to consider. So thank you for mentioning that. That's great.
Well, just to wrap up that piece, one example that I sometimes share with parents is that if they have a child who's been subjected to verbal or physical aggression, mm-hmm. perhaps the child with disabilities might have early onset schizophrenia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sibling that has grown up alongside that child might not have such warm, fuzzy feelings about it. So, so in terms of future planning, it is a family affair. Mm-hmm. We actually, one of our presentations is called Future Planning is a Family Affair. Mm-hmm. And we really look at all these different elements that go into a future plan.
That's great. I think, you know, some of the stuff that I've tried to do is just to get families to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think we wait too long for most things. I did, and that's why I shared kind of the planning part of guardianship, which is another topic, but you know, to start earlier and have some type of plan and making those decisions is really healthy for a family. So I'm always trying to stimulate those conversations.
Absolutely. But, and by the time the sibling is in, you know, mid to late teens, that's a great time to start these conversations because as they're planning to kind of leave the nest themselves, that's a perfect time to really take a look at the family dynamic and how it's changing and how what people's hopes and fears and dreams for the future are.
And it's always fears. I mean, that is the biggest one, and I get it. But if you need somebody that's in the position of, whether it's me or a teacher or somebody within our program, it's out there, and we're trying to get it just to have those conversations with the parents. And now they come and meeting with them and we're having conversations, and the conversation just could be about the emotions and how do they get to that next step. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing that we could do to help them get there, then I think that makes a huge difference. So,
And there, I was just looking through my notes here. There are four specific concerns that adult siblings tend to ask about. Mm-hmm. Are you interested?
Yes.
Okay. So the first concern is there enough money? That's always, you know, adult siblings oftentimes are caring for aging parents and their own children, and then a brother and sister with special needs all at once. And so a lot of siblings fear that they might not have the financial abilities to. The second concern that adult siblings tend to ask about is government benefits. What are they? Mm-hmm. Siblings need to know how to identify and access resources, and that includes government benefits for income and health care, SSI and Medicaid, as well as housing.
Very complicated.
The third concern is what legal documents are in place. So one of the interesting dynamics with siblings and their parents is that many parents are reluctant to hand over their responsibility for the individual with disabilities. And in part, that's because adult siblings tend to take more risks with the individual with disabilities. So, you know, a parent might say, John has always lived at home. He has to live at home. He can't live anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And the adult sibling might say, hey, let's try out a group home. John might love it. And then there can be this real, you know, tension between them. Yeah.
Those three. Is there one
Those three. And then the fourth one has to do with siblings not understanding disability-related language. Mm-hmm. Because parents, of course, have grown up learning all the acronyms, but siblings have this whole new language to learn. So if you say to an adult sibling, your sister was diagnosed with an SED, how well was she able to manage ADLs when she was involved with DMH or DSS? You know, you're going to see a panicked look in the eyes of the adult siblings because this isn't the language that they're fluent in.
Yeah, and special education, I think I did an article a few years ago just about the acronyms, because there's so many and it's so confusing.
And on the Massachusetts Sibling Support website, we do have a terrific publication called SIB Tips that was authored by Cindy Haddad, special needs estate person. And so that's a helpful resource for siblings.
Right. So on those four points, that's very interesting because, like, even for the government, you know, one, like, a sibling would have to know a little bit about that, you know, the brother or sister can get benefits or what is this. And I find for most parents that not even knowing what the resources are out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just did a couple of things on AFC and PCA. I mean, somebody may not even know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Got another acronym, but we did a whole podcast on adult family care. And so for a sibling to kind of navigate through MassHealth or SSI mm-hmm. can be very, very complicated. And it's the right question. No question. Yeah, but it's like you have to know about it and how they're all connected, how MassHealth is connected to SSI. And so that can go really deep. But number one, the finance piece, I can understand how would I actually be able to have the resources, funds, to be able to take care of my brother or sister, whatever, what their needs are.
Mm-hmm.
So those are interesting questions.
Well, so at the Massachusetts Sibling Support Network, we're just, well, pending funding. We're waiting to hear if we get a grant,
mm-hmm.
knock on wood. But we are about to launch a sibling mentoring project so that we match adult siblings and even younger siblings in the community we match trained sibling mentors in mm-hmm. the community with siblings that are struggling or need support or have questions around the topics that we've just discussed.
Wow.
So I'm pretty excited about that.
That sounds wonderful. That would be really helpful.
And I think that's an unmet need that we've identified in the sibling community. So
that's great.
Keep your fingers crossed for funding.
Yeah, good luck. I hope that turns out for you. I did a podcast, I should have shared this with you last time, with two staff people from lab that were siblings.
I listened to that.
Oh, you did? Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was interesting because both very invested and in the caring, but the future wasn't there yet of where they possibly could be, you know, like I was at that time. But we had such a great conversation just about, you know, what it was like and the differences and the similarities. Like I could see them being mentors or being somebody that could do those kind of things. And I think that, please let me know about that, because I think over the years I've met more people that are just have a nice way about themselves and are able to communicate what they need, but also just they have that, you know, emphatic nature to them that they can understand what's
mm-hmm.
going on. So let me know more. Do you give me the link to that and the email you sent me?
I haven't. It's on our website, but
okay.
Because we are still waiting to hear from funding,
oh,
we
so
haven't.
Oh, so you want to put out that? I get it.
It's listed as an upcoming initiative
on
our
okay.
website,
okay.
And I feel hopeful that we're going to get funding
good.
Because, you know, the Massachusetts Sibling Support Network is the only organization in Massachusetts that focuses exclusively on siblings.
Mm.
So we don't have much competition in that department.
Okay, yeah.
So that does, you know, give us, we stand out a little bit
mm-hmm.
when we're
okay.
applying
right.
for funds
good.
And things
but
like that.
But I think
that.
We could just, lab could be a possible resource to help get mentors.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
would be fantastic.
Yeah.
We have four volunteer mentors so far,
mm-hmm.
but if this program takes off, and I really hope it does, then my goal is to have 50 trained mentors in the
great.
State in the, over the next 3 years. So
that's
I'll
great.
Definitely
absolutely. Yeah.
I'll hit
yeah.
you up for
yeah.
some
yeah. Hey,
prospects.
That's another question I was thinking about a little bit earlier. So, you know, you're, like I said, there's not many organizations like this, so you have quite an area to cover and,
mm-hmm.
and kind of get out there. And I mean, how do you do that? I mean, as far as what you're thinking about and touching so many people in the state, I mean, that's quite an endeavor.
It is. I mean, it is. You think of Massachusetts as a small state, but then when you try to cover the entire
yeah.
state, you realize what a big region it is. So one of our goals is to make sure that we do cover the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
We unfortunately have some gaps where we don't have that much representation in the South,
mm-hmm.
on the Cape and Islands,
okay.
and we don't have much representation in Western Mass. So.
Yeah. When you say representation, you mean clients that...
Oh, I'm sorry. What I meant is the Massachusetts Sibling Support Network doesn't have staff or board members
oh, okay.
that...
Oh, from those areas, okay.
From those areas.
Yeah, yeah.
So We do actually have board members from the North Shore, the South Shore, and it's a very active board of directors. This past year, I became the executive director, and we got some funding to hire an admin as well. But until that time, we were a very active, all-volunteer board, and I was the president for the past 9 years. And so even though we all have full-time jobs and families and responsibilities, we all feel very committed to sibling issues. And so we pretty much would try to cover any sibling issue that would come up across the state.
Great. Awesome. No, I just, as we're talking, I think that it's so much stuff going on, so many programs, so many people, you know, out there. How can you cover it all? You know, I think just having a good board of directors, and you have a lot of energy and passion yourself, so I mean that really gets out there. So I want to just be able to be a resource for more people, because I know there's, I'm just thinking of people that could be accessing this that aren't.
I think there, you know, that's one of our one of the areas that we really need to strengthen too, is getting the word out who we are, what we do. We're doing more kind of virtual training, so people can, you know, through webinar or Zoom, so that we don't actually, so that people don't have to travel, you know, 3 hours across the state to to come to a an adult sibling meetup, for example. We have a core group of volunteer and adult siblings that meet monthly or bi-monthly to just provide support to one another. So we want that to grow and expand. And
That's awesome. Again, as I'm thinking too, even within our own organization, I think people feel, if they feel comfortable, you know, to be part of something, that they might come. And we have over 300 students in our program. So there's a lot of siblings just within our program. Would they feel more comfortable, you know, attending something that would be kind of connected to the program, at least to start? Because I think they may view it as, my brother or sister goes to the program, I'm willing to be a part of something within that organization, that at least just to get the seed of it going for them to kind of carry it on.
So you had mentioned when you were 13 or 14 and went to the support group at the Shriver Center that you didn't really want to go. And what we find with teen siblings is that, first, they don't identify as needing help, which is what you said. And they're also at a developmental stage where they're trying to individuate and kind of separate from their family. So it's a tough age group to connect with. So what I usually tell families, oftentimes I'll speak to the moms and they'll say, I really, you know, I want my daughter to come to this sibling support group, but I don't know how to get her there. And so we do have some recommendations. One of the recommendations is actually not to use the language of sibling support group. Because to tell your child that they need to go to a support group is like this big red flag. They think, there's no way. I don't want to go to a support group. You go to a support group. So instead, you know, we try to use language like, you know, your sister's in a program and there's the hospital or agency that she's affiliated with really wants to make sure that we're all doing okay. So there's going to be a check-in for parents, a check-in for siblings. I mean, it depends on the, you know, the facility that we're talking about. But there are ways to pitch this to younger siblings where they would be more likely to participate.
And I think what really has me thinking about this, just by the nature of the students that we're serving, that has significantly increased in the mental health and trauma. So as we think about that, you know, even the way that we're providing therapies, we're providing interventions, there's just new things coming out that you can't use the same interventions with a student with intellectual disabilities, with somebody who has mental health or trauma. So number one, somebody needs to know that. So as a program, we're developing those things and trying to get better at delivering those services. But also makes me think, in the age of anxiety and things that are going on, which is so pervasive, and having more students that having these diagnoses, that there is a real need for to really get this information out, to say to parents, listen, like that data that you're telling me and the research is so important, because we connect with research and we connect with the data numbers. Mm-hmm. But we're always asking ourselves the questions, you know, internally, because we see so much, we're trying to deal with the anxiety as a culture, not just the students, everybody is in this. And it's not just technology, that's a big part of it. But so that's why this is kind of appropriate that we're doing this podcast, because I think I didn't realize that you were doing that part with the research with the mental health and trauma. Mm-hmm. But that really stood out to me as being extremely important, that I want to make sure that comes across in this podcast, because those siblings and those parents, they need to hear this.
And one of the interesting dynamics among the siblings of kids with mental health needs that I work with is that they oftentimes, even though they've been subjected to physical and verbal aggression, they oftentimes are fiercely protective of the brother or sister with a disability.
Yep. Makes sense.
And that, and so there's a sense of overprotectiveness that they have, but it's also some oftentimes followed by avoidance. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, they might want to, they might challenge mom or dad or, and say, you know, leave him alone. He didn't mean to break the window or whatever. And then that brother might lash out at the sibling, and then the sibling just throws up his or her hands and retreats to the bedroom and says, I don't want to have anything to do with this. So that's a complicated and complex dynamic.
Absolutely.
With the overprotectiveness followed by avoidance in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. My other question was, you said you had 2,000 siblings that you were...
Well, so 2,000, over 2,000 family members.
Okay.
So,
okay, that's good.
So at UMass Medical School, we work actually with every member of the family, as long as they're over 5 years old. So we have grandparents, aunts, uncles, foster brothers, sisters, because as we know, disability impacts the entire family unit.
Yeah,
and so if you're just working with one part of the unit, like the individual with disability or the parents, that's not going to have the best outcome.
Yeah, absolutely.
As working with everybody.
Right. So how did you get, it seems like a lot to me, which is good, because the more you get, the more you can, but how did you get the word out for the study, and are you still looking for people to do the study with?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. So the way the research study works is that every family that is admitted to the inpatient psych, that has a child admitted to the inpatient psych unit at Cambridge Hospital, gets a call from one of our parent mentors.
Mm-hmm.
So these are parents with lived experience raising children with mental health issues alongside the siblings.
Yeah.
And they extend this personal, very warm invitation during a time of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've called about, probably about, you know, over 7,000 families in Massachusetts.
Wow.
Yeah. So that, and that's just at Cambridge Hospital, where the program is a research study. So the other sites where the program is a quality improvement initiative, you have to be a participant in that. You have to be either a client or a patient, a family member that receives services from those agencies in order to participate in those.
Okay.
In that program.
Yeah, we've done, over the years, since I've been at lab, we've participated in quite a few research studies on a myriad of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like it's kind of your obligation, because how do we get better at things unless we get people to do research with? So, and most times it's fun, it's interesting, the staff are really intrigued by it, the parents are intrigued by it, so it's not a burden on the program. Or so again, I say that just because getting the word out there, we like to be a resource to do that. But it's, when I heard the word 2,000, I'm thinking it seems like a lot, but maybe it isn't. where you want to be down the road, and you need a lot more clients to do
well. What I'm thinking is that it would be wonderful if we could come up with a different research study for lab families, for example. Maybe there's something that we can talk about that would be of use.
Yeah, if it's something that we think can, you know, benefit the families, you know, for the future. And, you know, I just think it's part of our responsibility to kind of look at that. And let's talk about that after the podcast. Maybe we can meet it another time. But if it's unique to our population, I mean, it's not unique to us. It's everywhere. But if there's something that we could contribute to that to try to help work. So we've always enjoyed to, you get a lot of research studies that come at you, and you kind of see the ones that really make sense, and that we could, you know. We did one on music, I think we were talking last time.
Oh, right.
And that was totally different than other research studies we had done. But again, it was a lot of fun. We ended up doing it twice, and I don't know where that research will go, but we know the impact on music and the brain, you know. And now they would, actually that study was students with Down syndrome, so they were kind of taking a unique slice, and who knows if that's, they needed a lot more people to do the study on, so even though we have 300 students, only a certain population of our students are Down syndrome, so I knew that they were struggling with trying to find people.
Yeah, in general, it is challenging to recruit for studies.
Yeah.
The Massachusetts Sibling Support Network, which does not conduct research studies, we do collect data on all of our presentations and attendees, and we ask everybody to fill out surveys on what they've learned, what they intend to do differently based on what they've learned, and some general demographics. So even though it's not considered research, we do have a growing body of data that really supports what we're doing.
That's great. We've talked about a lot.
Yes.
And
yes, sir.
It seems like we could talk for another hour, but I think, you know, the stuff that you're doing is amazing. I mean, certainly I have, you know, coming from that and experiencing the siblings, that's definitely dear to my heart. So I would certainly want to try to, a couple things, get all this information out through our newsletter, my blog, our Facebook. We'll absolutely do that. It'd be great for you to come and speak to our parent group, and we'll kind of talk about what that would look like.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's appropriate to do that now. I think we would get a lot of parents there to really listen in on this. And hopefully this podcast stimulates some of that.
Great.
And again, I look at that next part, you know, is there something in lab that we could do specifically, like you said, with the research, or is there a way that we can contribute to that? Because I think that would be interesting just for staff, for parents, for the community seeing that, and it could lead to other, you know, programs wanting to be a part of the same thing.
And even so, starting very simply with a survey, either surveying the staff, surveying the families, you know, sometimes staff want more education around sibling, how to support the sibling.
Absolutely.
So.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming.
Oh, what a
really
treat.
Really appreciate it. You're a natural on these podcasts. So just, you know, it seems like you were prepared, and you had some great data and some great things. But again, like I said, all of this information that Emily is a part of will be when I post up the podcast. So you'll be able to click on those links, enjoy it. I spent some time just going through those links myself and just watching some of the news stations that we're doing. So you are out there more than I thought, which was great. So we just want to be an extra hand.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.